Hello and welcome to another episode of the Profits and Prana podcast. My name is Esme. I'm a yoga teacher, web designer, business coach, digital strategist. I kind of do it all. And in today's episode, I'm speaking with my dear friend, Shell Horowitz. Shell is an award-winning author, international speaker, and marketing consultant with over 20 years of experience in the industry. Shell believes that businesses can be successful and profitable and ethical at the same time. In today's chat, we talk a lot about marketing, business, sustainability, ethical responsibility, and a lot more. So if any of these topics related to social responsibility and profitability are of interest to you, make sure you grab a pen and a piece of paper because Shell gives tons of value in today's episode and you are going to want to take some notes. Without any further ado, let's get right to the conversation. Thank you so much for joining me today, Shell.
It's a pleasure. Glad to be here.
So today I want to talk about a few things that you've been working on. I know you've got a lot of really interesting projects. And I think first we should start with Transformpreneur because social responsibility is something that a lot of people in my audience are interested in, and that's what you're all about. So why don't you tell us more about your Transformpreneur project and how people can really start to see themselves as a Transformpreneur instead of just someone who owns a small business?
Yeah, it's basically there. I set up two websites in the last year or so to really foster the new work that I'm doing of helping business transform hunger and poverty into sufficiency, war into peace, and catastrophic climate change into planetary balance. So Transformpreneur is a site that I set up for small businesses and entrepreneurs to show them how to leverage their skills and resources. And then I also have goingbeyondsustainability.com, which is aimed at more established organizations, corporations, or whatever. So it has a more formal look to it. But the idea is basically the same with both sites, that it's no longer enough to just go green, that sustainability itself is not enough, that we have to go beyond sustainability into actually regenerativity, into making the world better, not just keeping the status quo. And the nice thing is that there's a thousand ways we can do this. It's a very exciting project and very exciting time because I think for the first time we really can see ways to end these global crises that have never been available to us before, but with new things coming down the road in the last 20 years from social media to new technologies for harnessing the sun, et cetera, it's just so much possibility. And we now are in a situation where ordinary people can do things that maybe were harder for them to do before.
What kind of things can just the average everyday entrepreneur do that can really start to make a difference, not just for themselves, but for the community and the bigger picture?
Well, my very favorite example of this kind of thing is the number of companies that are making solar-powered LED lamps and selling them to people who've been using kerosene. And I hear you saying, so what? What's the big deal about that? Well, take a listen. First of all, kerosene lamps are highly flammable. The number of people killed or maimed in kerosene fires every year is just horrible. Number two, they generate toxic fumes. So even if they're not burning your hut down, they're not making it good for you and your children and your family to breathe. Number three, of course, they need kerosene every single month. You have to go out and buy it. And if you're making, let's say, $20 a month in some, you know, remote village somewhere and you're spending $2 a month on kerosene, that's a significant hit to your disposable income and your ability to climb out of poverty. And finally, they make crappy light. So you replace that with the solar-powered LED, you've eliminated the fire hazard, you've eliminated the toxic fumes, and once the lamp is paid for on time plan, you've eliminated the monthly payment. You get better light, so the adults in the household might be able to start a cottage industry after a day of farming, and the kids can see better to do their homework and get better grades and eventually better jobs. So this little $20 lamp becomes a ladder out of poverty. I think that's kind of the ideal, the perfect storm of goodness. It's profitable for the company, it's better for the family, and it's better for the environment. So that's not everybody is going to be able to come up with a project that does all of that at once, but pretty much all of us can come up with something that addresses at least a few of those kinds of pieces. And one of the things that I do is I help companies figure out, with your skills, with your interests, with your resources, what are the good projects that you can do, and then help them implement and market them.
I like the idea of being able to have this like little $20 light as a source for change. I think that's a really powerful idea.
Yeah, and it can work on pretty much any industry. For example, let's say you have a garden center. You could start a program to work with inner city teenage youth, teaching them farm and garden skills, and then being a market for what they grow so that they're not just starting it and then having to go and find customers. You'll actually buy the stuff they grow and sell it to your customers. And that's a very easy kind of thing to implement, a lot easier than designing from scratch a new kind of lamp. So lots and lots of things like that. There are the possibilities, as I said, they're really endless.
You know, you just reminded me of a group in Chicago that I really love what they're doing. It's called I Grow Chicago, and they bring yoga, gardening, sustainability, and art to inner city youth, and they help them become more mindful citizens. They help them become calmer, and they teach them how their actions impact the world in a larger way. Mm-hmm. So what you mentioned about the garden center just reminded me of that organization. I think we can do a lot more with little things like that, you know, urban farming and nutrition.
Yeah, and there's no downside to it. You're getting better food. You're getting citizens who grow up to care about the world that they live in and to grow up understanding that they have a role in it and that they have the ability to change things that aren't working. That's one of the things that I've really begun to kind of listen to in the history of the world is where the ordinary people step in and just make huge change. Everybody says, oh, I'm just one person, or I'm a nobody, what can I do? Well, think about how ordinary is a seamstress, and then think about a seamstress named Rosa Parks.
Good point.
You know, how ordinary is an electrician? Well, being an electrician in a shipyard didn't stop Lech Walesa from starting the Solidarity Movement in Poland, throwing the Russians out of Poland, and becoming its president. Ordinary people make huge difference.
So I really, really like that idea. So, and there's so many people I know who listen to this podcast who have said things to me like, well, you know, I'm just like everybody else. And well, maybe you are, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
You still have power.
Right. And the important thing, this is, I think, the piece that many people don't get, is that the ordinary person who acts alone is usually the tree falling in the forest with nobody listening. But the ordinary person who contacts their friends and neighbors and colleagues and creates a movement, well, that's something. Think about Lois Gibbs. She was a housewife in Niagara Falls, New York. And she discovered that a company called Hooker Chemical was dumping toxics in her neighborhood, and that that had a lot to do with a very, very high rate of disabilities and birth defects among the children in the area. And she didn't just say, this is terrible, but there's nothing we can do, or even, this is terrible and I'm going to stop it. But she got together the entire community, meetings with hundreds of people, and they organized. And that's why they were able to create change.
I really think something that a lot of people tend to struggle with is, you know, well, I've got this idea. Here's this problem that I'm seeing. It needs to be fixed. But how do I get people involved? How do I start a movement? How do I find people who care about the same things in the same way as I do? So is there a secret that you've noticed? Is there a trend among all of these social change makers?
I'm going to speak about my personal experience starting a successful movement. In November 1999, I read the front page of my local paper, had a big story about a developer who was going to build 40 luxury trophy homes on the mountain right next to the most beloved state park in the area, which is also a mountain, and 2 miles from my house, I might mention. And while they interviewed a number of experts in the environmental world, they all said variations on, oh, this is terrible, but there's nothing we can do. And quite frankly, it wasn't reading about the developers' plans that got me angry enough to act. It was reading about all these activists and envirotech people who should know better, who said there's nothing we can do. When I got to that part of the article, I decided to prove them wrong. And I organized a group called Save the Mountain. And I very consciously called it save the mountain and not save Mount Holyoke Range. So if there was another threat to another mountain nearby, we'd be all set to go. We didn't have to reinvent our brand. And I have a long history, both in organizing and in marketing, going back to the 1970s. So I drew on the skills that I had and the networks that I had. I called a meeting for about 2 weeks later, and between then and then, I sent out a press release to the local media. I flyered the neighborhood on my bike, and I got a lot of coverage in the local papers. And the day before the meeting, my phone started to ring and ring and ring. Oh, we really want to be involved. We can't make that meeting. Can you keep us on the list? By the time the dust settled, that meeting, we had 70 people crowd into my dining room. We actually had to move. We had, at that time, two tables in our dining room kitchen combined room. And we had to stack them to make enough room for people. And we had another 30 or so who called and said, can't come, but I really want to be involved. And part of it, I think, was the framing. That very, very first press release had a statement something like, Mr. Bercume, that was the developer's name, has vastly underestimated the love that people in Western Massachusetts have for this mountain. That was the framing that I built from. And that's a lot different framing from, oh, this is terrible, but there's nothing we can do. I always worked from the assumption that we would win. I thought it would be a five-year struggle. But because I think of that assumption that we would win, because everybody very quickly realized that we had almost a consensus in town and in the area that that project was a terrible idea and that we would be able to stop it, really, we won very, very quickly. We won in 13 months flat.
Wow.
And we had some victories along the way. It was going to be 40, and then it was 32, and then by the time the project was canceled, it was only 12.
Wow.
So, and the whole thing was 13 months, just over a year. And I was expecting to spend 5 years of my life on this campaign, so I was thrilled to win in just over a year. But we went, the other thing we did is we sought common ground. This was during 1999 and 2000. So we didn't frame it in terms of things that would piss people off. We framed it in terms of things that we could all agree on. And the results of that is you would drive around that neighborhood in October and November of 2000, and you wouldn't be too surprised to see lawn signs for Gore, and on the same lawn, a lawn sign for Save the Mountain, and Nader, and Save the Mountain, and holy crap, Bush, and Save the Mountain on the same lawn. Not just one place either. There were a few of those around town. And I would go into the town offices, and the town clerk, who was a very conservative, old line, part of the local political machine, would say things like, well, I'm supposed to charge you to make the copy of this document, but since it's for Save the Mountain, wink, wink, and she would just do it. we really united the entire town. So the biggest lesson I took away from that was that you can really build a consensus movement if you have the right framing. And the second biggest lesson I took from that is that we have the power to change our local community. We can probably change the world too. And that's when I really started thinking about how to reinvent my own business, which has been around since 1981, as an entity for social change.
Is that, it sounds to me like all of this has been leading up to your latest book. So from what, listening to you talk, it sounds like everything has been building on each other and leading up to Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World. And is that a fair assessment?
Yes, all the way back to my first activist action at age 3.
Wow, you got started early.
I did, yes. And, perhaps that was why when we did Save the Mountain, my kids both got involved. They were in first grade and sixth grade at the time. And both of them took a role. And my little first grade son would actually organize a raffle where he went to different merchants and got prizes, and he wanted to do a children's raffle. And we said, sure. So we drove him around to the stores where he could go. He like got a lot of sparkly animals donated, that sort of thing. And he did his little fundraiser for us. It was so cute. And now he's 23 and probably doesn't remember that.
Oh, he might. It's amazing what kids hang on to.
Yeah. So Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World is really a lot of what I've learned over the 40 plus years in both marketing and organizing about how business can be leverage to create change. And there are examples from solopreneurs on up to Fortune 50. And literally some of the biggest companies in the world are profiled in this book for some of the cool things they're doing. It talks about B corporations, which is an alternative organizational method where you don't have to focus solely on the short-term bottom line financials that most corporations are legally required to focus on. You can have a longer-term plan that is better for the world. You still have to show that you're going to make money on it, but you have a lot more flexibility. And interestingly enough, Unilever, which is one of the two or three largest consumer packaged goods companies in the world, is going for B Corp certification now.
Oh, that is really interesting.
Yeah, and I think they did it because Ben & Jerry's, which is owned by them, that unit was one of the first organizations to get B Corp certification 4 or 5 years ago. And when Ben & Jerry's was sold to Unilever, they promised that they would let the good ideas trickle up, and they're actually keeping their promise.
That's kind of amazing. Just in itself, like they're keeping their promises.
Yeah, and they still have an independent board. A friend of mine is on their board.
Wow.
He came to a potluck once with like 8 pints of Ben & Jerry's.
That's the kind of house guest I want.
Well, in the book, I do talk about how Ben & Jerry's competed directly with Häagen-Dazs. And this is a very interesting sector because the super premium ice cream market has some hundreds of players, but there are only 2 with any kind of market share. And they both typically have like 40 to 45%. It goes up and down who has more at any given time. But you have cold corporate Häagen-Dazs, the Exxon of ice cream. And you've got this hippie brand from Vermont, for goodness sake, with hand-drawn packaging in the early days. And people say, how is it that Ben & Jerry's was able to go head-to-head with Häagen-Dazs, which at the time was owned by Pillsbury, not a small player, and where did they get all their spunk? And I think a lot of it is because they've been walking their talk for their entire existence. You go to solar festivals and you see that they've got a sponsorship table and they're maybe giving out free ice cream even. And you go to their scoop shops and you realize that some of their scoop shops are hiring disabled people who would have a hard time getting another job. And you investigate where they get their brownie source from, and you discover it's Grayston Bakery, which is an open employment company where the way they hire is they take names on a list, and when your name comes up, you're offered a job. And it doesn't matter if you're an ex-felon, an ex-mental patient, a person with some kind of mental or physical disability, whatever it is. If your number comes up, you're offered a job and training, of course. And they have a very deeply loyal workforce, as you can imagine. And many people have used that after not being able to put together any kind of real experience. They work for Grayston for 2 or 3 years, and then they can go anywhere they want.
Wow. And that's where Ben & Jerry's, really powerful.
Yeah. And this is all profiled in the book.
And where did the inspiration for the book come from? I mean, you've put out so many books at this point, and it almost seemed like when you first announced this that how does he have more material? Like, I thought he would have been done by now, but you can keep going.
I have an entire file drawer of books I might like to write someday.
That's amazing.
This one came out, well, after Save the Mountain, as I said, I started slowly thinking about my own business. And right about that time was when all of those early 2000s business scandals were popping up, like WorldCom and Enron and Martha Stewart. And I thought, I've got a message for the world that the ethical practices in business are actually a success tool. So in 2003, I self-published a book called Principal Profit Marketing to Put People First. That puts people first. And that the core of that book is still in the new book. But in between, I really started focusing more on, if you're going to be an ethical company in this day and age, that means you have to be environmentally responsible. So that led to an expanded, updated, greatly more interesting version of the same material with a lot more environmental content that was called Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green. And that came out with Wiley in 2000. And then again, as I've been thinking about how to go beyond sustainability into regenerativity, I realized that I had a lot more to say. So there's another 40,000 words of new material that went into two-thirds of Guerrilla Marketing Goes Green, and was added to it to make guerrilla marketing to heal the world, which is a terrific book. It's my 10th book. It's the best thing I've ever written. I think it can be life-changing for people who never really saw how business could be an agent of change before.
I think so too. I've talked to a lot of people, and specifically my niche, I work with yoga teachers and formerly coffee shops. And it's so common to hear things from the business owners like, well, why would I try to have eco-friendly trash bags? You know, they're more expensive, like, and so on. And they only see the initial outlay.
Right. But they need to see the bigger picture, because actually doing this stuff means you build a loyal repeat clientele. It means you are able to retain employees more easily, thus you have lower human resources costs. It means that you are able to market to the green world, and it goes on and on. In the books, I discuss quite a bit about the advantages of these kinds of things. And the end result is there are so many ways that you can make the world better and go green that are both reducing cost and increasing income, that it's really a profitability strategy. And it's one that, quite frankly, if you don't do it soon, you're going to get left behind and maybe out of business. Because given the choice between comparably priced, comparable quality products and services, one with a social conscience and one without, it's a no-brainer that most people will choose the one with the social conscience. I might mention that there is a sampler with some of the key sections of Guerrilla Marketing to Heal the World that anybody listening can get for free. It's one of several gifts if you go to goingbeyondsustainability.com/freebies. You can get that, and I will give that out again later. So if you don't have a pen in your hand to write down goingbeyondsustainability.com/freebies, get one now, and I'll say it again at some point when it makes sense to do that. And there are a number of gifts on that page, including two assessments you can take, one about whether your business is ready to become a green business, and another whether it's ready to become a social entrepreneurship business. And filling that out actually gets you a brief consultation with me personally. So that's a really good deal.
Awesome. Well, I'm definitely going to link to that in the show notes, just as an aside for anybody listening. If you don't have a pen, you can just click in the show notes in your iTunes podcast player, and you can go right to the link.
Yes, which is, once again, if you're assuming you picked up your pen by now, goingbeyondsustainability.com/freebies.
Yes, and you've got some really amazing stuff there, including the slide deck from your TED Talk.
Yeah, yeah, or actually it's the master deck, which includes more than fit in the TED Talk.
Oh,
TED Talk was only 15 minutes, and I use that deck to cull whatever slides I'm going to do for presentations of up to an hour. So there's a very rich load there. It's about 70, 80 slides.
Wow, that's amazing. You're just giving that away. That's very generous of you.
I'm a generous person.
Yes, I do know that. So, a couple things I just wanted to make sure that we touch on is my audience on this podcast, mostly yoga teachers, a lot of studio owners. What's something that someone who owns a business that doesn't necessarily have a lot of waste could do to be a more socially involved and responsible business, but without necessarily having to, quote, go green because they aren't generating much waste, and maybe they don't have control over where their electricity comes from. Maybe they can't install solar panels.
Sure, maybe they're renting the studio.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, first of all, there's the social conscience category. You could take that yoga program and go to an inner city elementary school and offer to teach yoga for free to fourth graders. And then you could lever, that's obviously a time commitment on your part, but not a money commitment, assuming you've got some yoga mats lying around anyway, because you run a yoga studio. And then you can get publicity for doing that. You can go to your local papers and write a press release about how you, as a local yoga studio, have decided that this is something you can do. And think big. Think about the long-term implications of what you're doing. Might mean fewer people involved in gang violence, more mindful children who become more mindful teenagers, who become more mindful adults, who can focus on their skills and get better jobs. who can learn good study habits because of the yoga. Really spin it out in all the different directions. I'm brainstorming here. I have not given any thought to how a yoga studio could become a more socially responsible business. So this is right off the top of my head here. Of course, I'm very happy if anybody wants to talk to me one-on-one. I do offer individual consulting at pretty reasonable prices. And
yeah, they're gone.
Yeah, so that's one possible avenue. Another would be to take it even bigger and look at regional conflicts between politicians. I know that you're up in the Adirondacks, not too far from Canada, so, and I know that your listeners are probably all over the place. But since you are near a border area, let's talk about what that might be like. Where are there borders that have conflicts? Where could a mindfulness practice really make a difference in how global problems are solved? What kinds of programs could an ordinary yoga teacher in some small town that happens to be near an international border do to resolve conflict? And if that person happens to be, let's just say, in Iraq or Syria, that could be globally life-changing.
Wow. Yeah, I tend to think about the community around me, and then I seem to struggle with the bigger picture and the ripple effect. So it's really the ripple effect of, you know, this person might end up going over here. Like, that's where I tend to get hung up. So is there a method that you have that makes it easier to think about all of the ripple effects, or is that just something that you've been doing with practice?
It's mostly, I could do it for you one-on-one. If you were a consulting client of mine, we could really walk through that and determine probably four or five different ways that you could have that kind of impact, and then it would just be a matter for you to pick the one that you like best. I don't have any kind of trademarked process for doing this. It's very intuitive. But it's there. It's. I have yet to find any business that somebody has thrown at me that I couldn't spin out into, this is how you can make an impact on these big problems of hunger, poverty, war, and catastrophic climate change.
That's awesome. So, and very needed, I think. And I think especially in the yoga industry, we want to be part of something, but it's harder to see how we fit in. We're like, oh, I'm just a yoga teacher. And I think for a lot of people who are just getting started with yoga and mindfulness, it can be challenging to start to see the bigger impact that your work can have outside of yourself.
You need to, here's your next business. You can do up bumper stickers that say yoga changes the world, or yoga can change the world, and have a URL. And that's all it would say. And I think yoga is a very easy business to see as transformative because it's personally transformative for the people who take it.
Yes, very.
But beyond that, one of the famous 60s gurus, I forgot who, had this idea that the whole world, if they could get the whole world meditating, they'd end war.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably right. I think it would be very challenging to meet that goal.
Yes, so do I. But, it needs a lot of resistance.
You were saying before how you get stuck in not thinking big enough. He was thinking big enough.
Yeah. Yes, he was.
So then the question is, how do you implement it? How do you execute it? How do you get the 10 million yoga teachers you would need to be out there dealing with 7 billion people in the world, or 9 billion people in the world? So that's roughly one for every 1,000 people in the world, one yoga teacher. I think that would be enough to make critical mass.
Yes, and that I think is something that could be achieved. So we have the internet. So it's not unreasonable to assume that you could reach 1,000 people.
Yeah, and because of the internet, we now have so many more resources. We don't have to invent everything ourselves. We can see, if you're in the Adirondacks, you can see what is a yoga teacher doing in Southern California that I might be able to borrow.
Yes.
Certainly that excerpt that's on the freebies page, goingbeyondsustainability.com/freebies, we talked about Ben & Jerry's and Grayston Bakery. Those two pieces of the book are among the several pieces that are in that excerpt.
Oh, excellent. Excellent.
And there's also the section that's called Impossible as a Dare, proves that we already know how to turn hunger and poverty into sufficiency, war into peace, and catastrophic climate change into planetary balance.
Yes, yes. Very, very hard to, I think, imagine that we can go from that. We can go from something that's tragic to something that's positive and life-changing for so many people. So, yes, definitely they need to go get that slide deck.
Yeah, and I'm going to go into my marketing teaching hat for a moment.
Go ahead.
Because I'm just going to point out what I'm doing here. You mentioned that I'm generous. Yes, I'm generous. I give away a ton of stuff. But I'm also giving this with the expectation that people will buy the book and people will read the book and then contact me to see about paying me to give a talk or having me come in and consult with them. So my generosity is it's altruistic, but it's also self-promoting.
Yeah.
And I have no problem with that. I'm giving great stuff away, and I fully expect that because I'm giving great stuff away and people will find value in it, that they'll find value in what I offer that I do get paid for.
And I think that's a component that a lot of people are missing because, and yet, this is especially an issue in the yoga world. So there's this concept that if you get paid, you're doing it wrong. And I don't know where that came from, but it's like there's this belief that making money by teaching yoga isn't yogic. And therefore, you are not a good yoga teacher if you're charging. And there's so many teachers out there who are giving things away. They are creating such goodwill among their audience that if they were to decide, yes, I do want to actually make a living doing this, that will come back to them. Because they've been putting all of this out there, they've been so generous. Mm-hmm. But there's this mindset shift that really seems to be an issue in this industry.
Yeah, and we sure see it in the green world, let me tell you.
Oh, I can imagine.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're making the world better, you should just give that away. Well, I don't actually have a mortgage payment anymore. My house is paid off because the strategy works. Mm-hmm. but I do a certain amount of pro bono work. I will speak at certain conferences for free, especially if they're close by or if they give me a bigger stage, like doing the TEDx talk that you drove down to see some years ago. By being able to label myself as a TEDx speaker, that was well worth a few hours of my time to go through that process, to develop the talk, to have it feedbacked and coached and practiced, and then to do the live event. And then from here on in, I'm a TED talker forever and ever. Nobody can ever take that away from me. And I have certainly found that that opens doors. That's one of the credentials I have, along with the 10 books, that opens doors faster and more easily than pretty much anything else. So it was worth it for me to do that one for free. But I get like, come to our conference in Korea and you'll pay your own airfare and hotel, of course, and then you'll speak for free and maybe we'll even charge you a conference fee. although I'm in the process of writing a proposal to go after corporate sponsors. And one of the options I'm going to offer to them is that they can fund me to do those sorts of things, to speak on those stages where their audience is there waiting and my audience is there waiting. And right now, it doesn't make any financial sense for me to go to them because the conferences will have me if they don't have to pay me. No problem.
Oh, yeah. they don't like to pay people, so they can get it for free.
If I'm going to take 5 to 7 days off my business and fly all the way across the world and deliver value over there, I need to have a way of making an income from that. I am not independently funded. So corporate sponsorship is a way that I can do that while keeping my integrity. I'm going to be very careful about who I accept sponsorship money from. And anybody who wants control over my content, they're not getting it.
Good. That I think could be catastrophic for you.
Yeah. Well, I'm just not going there. I think it will not be hard to find good companies to sponsor this work.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And it sounds like this is becoming a more
urgent.
While urgent, but also practical.
Yeah. And I've spent really the last 3 years putting the pieces in place so that I can go out there and find people who will pay for this message, whether it's consulting or speaking or writing. All of those are really about communication and about problem solving. And those are things that I'm very good at. And, you know, I have the book. I have the credential of the TEDx. I have a number of other credentials, such as I did a main stage presentation at the Green Festival in New York City in April, which was
actually... I know. I wanted to go to that so badly.
I have a recording of it, but quite frankly, the acoustics were not great in there. But from that and from some other talking that I did right when the book came out, I was able to put together a brand new speaker demo video, which is another essential piece that I had to have and couldn't have until I had a few recent live gigs, because my old one had been done at a time when my work really hadn't evolved to be talking about regenerativity and to be talking about how ordinary people make a difference. So I have it now. So it's been a slow, I've learned that I can be a patient person in spite of being raised in New York City. And certainly I was not patient in my teens and 20s, but I've learned now. I did a 10-year campaign on business ethics when Principled Profit was a new book. From 2004 to 2014, I ran a pledge campaign to get 25,000 signatures on an ethics pledge in order to reach that critical mass and change the business world. The interesting thing was I didn't come anywhere near 25,000 signatures, but I do feel like I had an effect. And the climate, the business culture actually changed, and I like to think that I had at least a little bit to do with that.
That's good. So I had no idea about that campaign.
Yeah, by the time you and I met, it was already over.
Yeah, well, there you go.
No, that's not right, actually, but it was winding down.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, that would make sense then. So a couple things that I just want to make sure that we get in before we start to wrap up here. I have a question for you. What is the one thing that someone listening, whether they're a business owner or not, maybe just an ordinary person, can do to start to have an impact?
The biggest thing you can do to have an impact is to change your mindset into that is possible, that is doable, that is, in fact, not even all that difficult to do. It is really a mindset shift. Once you've made the mindset shift, the specifics follow, and they're going to be different for every person. But when we did Save the Mountain, the biggest obstacle I had was the public perception that we were doomed to failure. And it took us about 3 months to overcome that. And then I didn't know it, but after the end of that 3 months, we had actually won. And the next, 10 months were all about working out the logistics of how we won. I was not even aware of this as the founder of the movement, of what was going on behind the scenes. All I knew is that our legal committee kept saying, trust in us, things are going to work out just fine. And we just did, and we said, okay, but meanwhile, we kept organizing. But the end result was that we really won almost instantly in this thing that everybody said was impossible, because we changed the idea from impossible to possible. I like to say, I called my TED Talk, Impossible is a Dare. It's taken from a great quote from Muhammad Ali, where basically he says, impossible is not a fact. It's a challenge. It's the red flag in front of the bull.
I didn't know that about that talk name. So how did I miss that?
I don't know. I believe you have the book. Yes. It's yeah. Toward the very back of the book.
Okay.
It's 303 or something, 323. Look up Muhammad Ali in the index and you'll find it very quickly. It's a wonderful quote.
I will definitely do that. So, and where can people get more information about you? Because I know you're everywhere. So you can count on all the social networks, you've got multiple sites. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
The best way is to visit either transformpreneur.com or goingbeyondsustainability.com. And there's a contact page there. That's to send me an email. You can also phone me. My number is 413-586-2388. I'm on Twitter under my own name, Shelhorowitz, Shel Horowitz with one L and a T, not a C, toward the end. Well, it's amazing how many people can mess up my name. And then my email address is shel@greenandprofitable.com, which is another one of my sites.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to link up to all of that in the show notes as well. So, shellgreenandprofitable.com. So, yes, people can definitely, they've got multiple ways to get in touch with you. This is awesome.
Yeah, and I love transparent. Yeah, and again, if you do those assessments on the freebies page, you actually can get 15 minutes of my time for free. So, and that the whole idea of that is to get you really moving forward on figuring out and implementing what kind of work you can do to make the world better while making money.
Yes, and that's the key, because you know, and people don't seem to understand that when you are struggling to pay your bills, it's harder to have a bigger impact. Because you start to prioritize things that pay the bills, whether they're responsible, ethical, or not. So I really think that what you're
saying... That's a very short-term view, though, because in general, the things that are responsible and ethical are also long-term going to be more profitable. You know, for many businesses, the hardest part is attracting a new client or customer. And when you treat people right, when you're behaving according to the wider rules and not just to the service of the short-term bottom line, you don't cheat people. You treat them well, and they remember that, and they come back to you. And they, if they see you as a force for a greater good, they will even refer other people to you. They'll become your evangelists, your ambassadors.
Yes.
So doing the right thing, as I've been saying since that first of the three books I've done on this, four books, came out in 2003, that doing the right thing is a success strategy. So it's better to build it in from the beginning.
I love that. And I think that's a great note to wrap up on. Thank you so much for joining me. I don't want to take up any more of your time. I know we ran a little bit late, and I do apologize for that.
That's okay. It was fun.
It was. And I think, you know, there's so much in here that people can get value out of and take action on. So thank you so much for sharing. Thank you so much for being generous.
You're welcome. And I'll be happy to share the link when you send it to me.
Yes. Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much.